From NPR on WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Anthony Brooks in Dublin, New Hampshire. It's Here and Now. MIT mechanical engineering professor Gong Chen is savoring a hard-won legal battle against the Department of Justice. He was arrested a year ago and charged with hiding financial ties to China on his applications for U.S. government grants.
Chen is one of several scientists targeted by what's called the China Initiative. It's a federal effort to stop the Chinese government's theft of American ideas and science. But it's been criticized by many for failed cases, for accusing innocent people, and for targeting ethnic Chinese persons. Last week, the government announced it is dismissing the case against him, and Professor Chen joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Scott. It's my pleasure.
Now, your story starts 2 years ago when you were detained at Logan Airport in Boston. Can you tell us what happened there?
Yes. In January 2020, I went to Chang'an, Egypt, and then my family also joined me. We had a vacation in Morocco. When I returned, arrived at the Logan Airport, I was stopped at the custom, and they brought me and my family to an isolated area and questioned me, and took all my electronics away, computer, phones.
What did they ask you?
They asked what I was doing on this trip, because I had a business trip in China and also business trip in Egypt. But clearly, they were only interested in China. So they asked more questions about what I was doing in China. So I told them we had collaborations, and they asked more detail, and I answered as best I could, but I also knew there are things I should not say. For example, they asked my computer password, and there's no
secret. They asked for your password.
Yeah, they asked my phone password. They asked my computer passwords. And at the end, I knew from MIT legal counsel, this was actually before the trip, I learned I had the right not to tell them. So I didn't tell them.
Wow. And then it was a full year later when federal agents came to your house, first thing in the morning, arrested you. What did they say? What did they do that morning?
Around 6:30 a.m., a group of federal agents stormed into my home, and I asked them, what's my crime? What they are charging me? And they said, wire fraud. I didn't know what that mean. I heard about this before. I didn't know what it mean. I had a lawyer at the time, and the lawyer advised me not talk to them. So I did not ask more.
These agents, did they question you? Did they arrest you? Did they handcuff you in front of your family?
Oh, yeah. My wife and my daughter were at home, and both of them saw I was handcuffed and taken away. And my wife, who got very emotional, started talking to them. And I asked her to stop. She could not stop. So that really worried me.
Your arrest came in the last few days of the Trump administration. We, of course, know what President Trump said, has had to say about China and about the virus and its origin. In your view, was this timing political to arrest you before the presidency changed hands?
Oh, absolutely. Let me tell you that in December 2020, my lawyer, she was told by the prosecutors that there was no imminent indictment, at least for another 6 months. And they told also the MIT external lawyer the same thing. And then in January, they arrested me. That was just less than a week to go in the Trump administration.
Yeah.
And Mr. Lenin wanted to have a high-profile news conference. In this news conference, Mr. Lenin and the FBI special agent in charge just said things that not true.
Eventually, their case, of course, fell apart. You were accused of grant fraud for not disclosing ties and funding from Chinese institutions. But it turns out none of the grants you applied for at the Department of Energy even required that information. And it turns out the U.S. government withheld information for months that could have exonerated you. It sounds like they botched this investigation from the beginning.
Absolutely. They did not do their interview of critical witness before they arrested me. U.S. Department of Energy had a new rule in October 2020. And that this rule would imply that some of those should be reported. But they used the new rule in 2020 and applied to 2017 and 2019. And there was no place you can report those. That was just not in those standard forms.
During this case, you've said that your life for you and for your family was hell. How so?
There are so many moments. I woke up during night because my wife was crying in her dream. And she kept asking why. She knew I did not do nothing wrong. It's just as it completely destroyed my reputation that I worked very hard in my life to build. It destroyed my research group. It's just as it ruined people's life.
This broader China initiative, as you know, has been roundly criticized for a number of reasons, for its focus, apparent focus on ethnic Chinese persons and focusing on these academic disclosures rather than cases of actual economic espionage. We did speak to Andrew Lelling. You mentioned him, the former U.S. attorney in Boston during the Trump administration. And he said the government should now focus less on academics. Let's take a listen.
The point of the initiative back in 2018 was to sensitize the public to this problem and to deter academic researchers from failing to disclose their affiliations with Chinese counterparts. That deterrence has been achieved. There's no academic researcher in the sciences who isn't concerned about this.
So Andrew Lelling's perspective is that the program has had some success in getting academics to be more transparent about their ties to China. From your perspective, what do you think should happen next? Do you want certain people to be held accountable in the Justice Department?
I certainly would like to request an investigation by the Congress and by the Department of Justice for the misconduct. And Mr. Lenin himself said many times, the purpose is creating chilling effect. I want people to know that this chilling effect really terrified the scientific community. It, of course, mostly terrorized the Chinese Americans, but the entire scientific community, not just the Chinese, when they say how they accused me and other people, and this really hurt international scientific collaboration. And if you look at the COVID-19, you look at the global warming, there are no border between countries. And the way as scientists have to work together, collaborate. If the government wants to be clear, then clearly specify what should be listed. But what they have done is not this success, it's a damage to the scientific community, damage to U.S. Now people fear, talents fear the political environment and they leave the country. And talents don't come. We lose. We are all losers.
Gang Chen, that's my last question for you is on that question. Your background is a familiar one to me. Your parents in China during the Cultural Revolution were punished for being the wrong class. They were sent to the countryside. My uncle had the same experience, and then when the madness ended in the 70s, the schools came back, the college entrance exam came back, and he, like you, became an academic star. And then you came to America. Today, do you think that same person will be interested in coming to the U.S. to do research?
That's a really good question. I came here for American Dream. I'm very grateful to this country for giving me what I had achieved. But it really saddens me to say the same country come to destroy me because of what I have achieved. And I still have hope. I still have hope. People are so brave. MIT faculty, MIT leadership, and so many people stood out. Really, people's brave and kindness give us hope. We have to speak out how damaging this is.
Gang Chen is a professor of mechanical engineering at MIT. Professor Chen, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
In a statement, U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins said, prosecutors have an obligation, quote, to continually examine the facts while being open to receiving and uncovering new information. And she says, dismissing the charges against Chen is a, quote, result of that process and is in the interests of justice.
A blockbuster video game series
coming through
is getting the Hollywood treatment.
I've been dreaming about this my whole life. Magellan's gold. It's the biggest treasure that's never been found.
$5 billion, easy.
Uncharted, a critically acclaimed video game franchise. It's known for its lush set pieces, top-tier actors, and cutting-edge animation. A new remastered collection of the latest games is out today. It's called Uncharted Legacy of Thieves Collection. And in 3 weeks, a new movie based on the series opens in theaters, starring Tom Holland and Mark Wahlberg. Joining us now is Neil Druckmann, creative director and writer on the last main Uncharted game, A Thief's End. Hi, Neil.
Hey, nice to be here.
And Asad Kizilbash, he's head of PlayStation Productions. Welcome to you, Asad.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What explains the success of Uncharted?
Yeah, you know, when we set out to make Uncharted, we were trying to, in a way, reverse engineer summer blockbusters. But like our favorite kind of summer blockbusters that have like really compelling stories, epic action. And then we're like, how do we build those cinematic set pieces, but make you care about the characters? And I think that's a big part of why the franchise took off the way it did. It's just people fell in love with these characters and their relationships and like these epic journeys they went on.
So for folks that don't know, I want to just explain a little bit about what Uncharted is. It's about an international adventurer and thief named Nathan Drake, and he's been described as a sort of younger, more mercenary Indiana Jones type character. So let's listen to a little bit from Uncharted.
That's Avery's cross.
They brought it out of storage just before you guys got here.
Well, there's got to be some way we can grab it.
There is just a small matter of a few hundred eyewitnesses down there.
Okay, but we just need a diversion.
So now comes a movie based on this video game. I'd love to talk to you about this, because is there some way you need to think about sort of the character that is created by the game that you want to sort of hold on to on the big screen? How do you think about that?
I think like any good adaptation is like you take the core of it, the spirit of it, what works, and then translate it, which means you have to change certain aspects of it to fit this new medium. You know, like when Batman was adapted by Tim Burton in 89, it's like they took certain liberties with what the comic book does, but they were able to still keep the spirit of that character and what that character meant. And that's, I think, what the team here has done extremely well, is just to take these kind of core principles, these relationships, adapted to this medium, to the spectacle of seeing it on the big screen, instead of playing it in your hand.
Sure. So my understanding is that this movie had been kicking around Hollywood for over a decade. It passed through a bunch of hands. I heard that Mark Wahlberg was originally tapped to play Nathan Drake, but he aged out of that role into the role of Nathan's mentor, Sully. How much did that affect the direction of the movie, do you think?
So I think, obviously, with any films in Hollywood, things take a lot of time, and you know, when things really started to gain momentum and interest sort of came in from our side and things started to move on the project, is when the creative take of actually having this more of an origin story or telling a part of a story that wasn't explored in the games, so sort of Nate in his early 20s, it introduces this whole new audience who've never heard of any of these characters, but at the same time, it offers a completely fresh take for fans who've spent, you know, decades playing this game. So that's, for us, when it really started to get a lot of momentum and a lot of steam.
So let's return to the game that's coming out today, a remastered version of Uncharted: A Thief's End. It's about an aging Nathan Drake at the end of his career as a fortune hunter. So here's a bit of sound from the game.
Oh, man, listen, I can't. I'm out.
What?
No, I just don't do that kind of thing anymore. Besides, there are plenty of other guys that are much more equipped to handle this kind of thing.
Neil, tell us about the Nathan Drake that you wrote.
Well, so when we made Uncharted 4, Thief's End, you know, that we're now re-releasing for the PS5 remastered along with Lost Legacy, we were trying to look at all the previous Uncharted games and the arcs that these characters have gone on, that here's Nathan Drake, this person that's really good at heart, but has this obsession. He's like almost like an addiction to adrenaline, to this adventures, to being in these really dangerous situations, and to these historical mysteries that he just can't let them go, and it's been really affecting his personal relationships with the really with the people closest to him. And it was interesting to explore that and find, for us as game makers, the metaphor of, like, you know, we've made certain sacrifices to make this art. How do you find that balance? Can you strike that balance between this thing you feel like you're meant to do and these people that you love and that you feel like you want to spend time with? And it's like, at some point, something has to give. And that gave us this emotional through line to then explore this guy that's been aging, that's been doing this his entire life. And it's like, where do you want your life to end? Like, where do you want it to go when you're at the end of this journey? Even though he's doing these crazy, over-the-top things, is really relatively grounded in how vulnerable he is, both physically and emotionally.
Mm. Now, a lot of people point to sort of Indiana Jones as a kind of inspiration. Is that fair? Are you tired of hearing that? What other inspirations do you have in mind as you write this story?
Yeah, no, I think that's totally fair. I mean, we're all massive fans of Indiana Jones. But we were looking at way beyond Indiana Jones as far as inspiration. It's like, for myself, it's like Die Hard is a big inspiration. I remember when I first saw that movie as a kid, it just like blew my mind of what like an action movie could be and the kind of hero you could have in an action movie. He was like, with John McClane, you have someone that's very grounded, and really it's dealing with a guy that's like on the verge of divorce, and how can he reconcile this very personal relationship while terrorists are trying to take over the building that he's in. What we would do is we would break down all these in different mediums. Sometimes it's TV shows. Firefly was another big inspiration for us. And we would just kind of like see the tropes that they deal with and how they subverted them, how they changed them, what kind of characters exist in this world, and then think, okay, what's a similar world we want to create with a similar tone, but obviously create our own cast of characters that have their own wants and needs and interesting obstacles and villains that get in their way.
I'd like to ask you both about sort of aspects of A Thief's End that sort of contrast with each other, and that is, it's a thrill ride. There's lots of running and chasing and shooting and everything that you sort of expect from a game.
We're running out of room, kid. I know.
But it can also get very quiet with these sort of intimate moments between these characters, almost as they unravel.
How long have we been chasing this thing, huh? You and me. No offense to these guys, but they don't get it.
Actually, Sam, they do. They really do.
Okay.
Trust me, they've seen this kind of obsession before.
Sort of, can you talk about how you think about those two aspects of the game, those sort of quiet set pieces versus the really sort of gripping action?
Yeah, you know, we're not afraid to spend a lot of resources on quiet beats. Because if you just have the whole game cranked to 11, at some point you become numb to it. Versus what makes interesting pacing and interesting story are the ebbs and flows of having a quiet moment of like, how do we make a moment where a character is just having dinner with his wife and we need them to connect? How do we make that playable? How do we get you to connect with those characters in an interactive way?
Hey, are you happy?
Yeah, of course. You? Really?
Versus a sequence where, you know, there's a convoy of trucks that the character is jumping from truck to truck and fighting people. And it's like, how do we make that compelling in an interactive way?
How are we doing back then? Not good at all. Keep shooting. I am.
And I think you got to have all those elements, all those facets to show the full kind of breadth of an adventure.
I want to ask you about a little bit of a transition, a dramatic transition, I guess. Nolan North has been Nathan Drake for a long time, since 2007. Now Tom Holland, of Spider-Man fame, is taking on the role for the movie. How is that torch being passed? What do you make of that? Asad, maybe you want to take that up.
I mean, what we found is both Tom and Mark are just incredible diverse actors, you know, comedy, drama, action, and also fans and know the game really well, and that helps as well. I think we were all surprised at how much Tom was so influenced and such a fan of the game, and that helps. And he really wanted to do it justice, but then also bring his own fresh take.
Sure. Asad, PlayStation Productions is behind more and more crossovers. So I'm curious if you think film, TV, and games are only going to become more aligned with each other in the coming years in this way.
I would say absolutely yes. It's a really exciting time. I think I personally feel that some of the sort of best, most exciting storytelling is actually coming from video games now. And you look at, you know, Arcane, for example, or The Witcher, and The Last of Us, which Neil is co-writing there for a series with HBO. The other thing I think is that we're going through this whole time where there's a new generation of film and TV creators, so writers, directors, who've actually grown up playing these video games and have this whole respect for the storytelling and art that's coming from video games. The PlayStation Productions in general, you know, we've obviously got this film coming out. In total, we've got 10, you know, shows and films in development in total.
Wow.
Yeah, lots of great stories yet to come.
Wow. Neil, it sounds sort of like a brave new world. I mean, this kind of intermingling of all these different media.
Yeah, no, I the thing that's actually really exciting for me is, you know, games are continue to mature and evolve and draw on a new audience. And I can't wait for that moment, you know, for someone to watch a movie or a TV show and just be enthralled by the storytelling within it. And then also be surprised and be like, wait, that's based on a video game? I didn't realize video games have evolved this much. Let me go check it out. Let me go see the origin of where this thing came from. There's something that's very exciting there for me.
That's Neil Druckmann, creative director and writer for Uncharted. The latest games have been remastered and released today as Uncharted Legacy of Thieves Collection. And Asad Kizilbash, head of PlayStation Productions, one of the many minds behind the upcoming Uncharted film starring Tom Holland and Mark Wahlberg. Gentlemen, thank you both very much.
My pleasure. Absolutely.
Cool. Thanks, Anthony.
This week, the James Webb Space Telescope reached its parking place in orbit, about 1 million miles away from Earth. It blasted off on Christmas Day and took 30 days to get there. Hundreds of things could have gone wrong. But after a stunningly successful journey, the telescope now could spend the next 20 years surveilling the cosmos, beaming back information and pictures to Earth. Mike Menzel joins us now. He's NASA's lead mission systems engineer for the James Webb Space Telescope. Mike, great to have you, and congratulations, by the way.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having us.
So this past month has been an exciting one for NASA. Tell us what makes this telescope so special.
Well, it's the largest telescope ever put into space. It's actually bigger than the rocket that carried it into orbit, so it has to do a series of unfoldings. We call them deployments. And deploying anything in space is always a very risky business. And in essence, what we did was after we launched the telescope, we rebuilt it on orbit. Pretty soon we'll be aligning it and focusing it and getting our first, first images from it.
It's really amazing to think about this sort of unfolding like a robot from the Transformers. I imagine there've been some tense moments for you. I mean, how exciting has this been for all of you at NASA to sort of watch this take shape 1 million miles away?
It's been extremely exciting, and it's been extremely gratifying. You know, we've spent, you know, literally 20 odd years preparing for all the things that could go wrong, trying to design them out, trying to have contingency procedures. These were tense moments for us. Nobody, you know, no satellite engineer likes to deploy things on orbit, especially this complex. So it was very reassuring and gratifying when we saw everything come together the way it did.
So, Mike, tell us a bit about what we can expect to see. What do you anticipate that the Webb will find?
The telescope was designed with four objectives, with one one extra in mind. It wants to see the first galaxies that turned on in the universe after the Big Bang, about 13.5 billion years ago. It wants to watch how those galaxies change over time. It wants to see stars being born in our own galaxy, and it wants to see how solar systems evolve. But in addition to those four things that were the science objectives, you know, some 25 years ago when we started, it now also wants to look and do some detailed investigation of the 4,000 odd planets we know of around other stars called exoplanets. It's not only going to fulfill those objectives, but that, you know, it'll have an actual sixth thing. And that is, if history is any teacher, every time we put a new telescope in orbit, we find stuff we never thought to ask. We find surprises. And that's the thing that excites me the most.
Fascinating. I'm just curious about it. When something is a million miles away and you're trying to communicate with it, or you are communicating with it and telling it to do stuff, how long does that signal actually take to reach it?
About 4 seconds.
That's amazing. So what's next? When can we expect to actually see something from Webb?
So far, everything's been going very well. And, you know, there's every reason to expect those images will be out there in the June timeframe.
All right. Mike Menzel, he's the lead mission systems engineer at NASA for the James Webb Space Telescope, which is now in orbit about a million miles away from Earth. Mike, thank you so much, and good luck to you.
Thanks, Anthony.
A powerful winter storm is barreling up the East Coast. 75 million people from the Southeast to New England are bracing for heavy snowfall and winds close to hurricane intensity. Meteorologists are warning that the nor'easter could knock out power and flood some coastal areas. Let's bring in Mark Elliott with the Weather Channel. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Scott. How are you today?
I'm well. As the storm moves up the coast, what does the snowfall look like now?
Yeah, a big storm with big snow potential. Also, unfortunately for some of you, a big bust potential. And we'll talk a little bit about what that could mean. For New York City area, maybe 5 to 8 or so. But, you know, central Long Island could see 15 to 20. And central New Jersey, 3 to 5. So we're talking, what, a 5-county difference and a 10-inch difference in snowfall. That is really, really difficult. It's a tight gradient on that western edge for sure. But as the low goes up the coast, the numbers get even bigger. We're talking about 2 feet in the Boston area. Again, a tight cutoff to the west, but that west cutoff is a little bit further west. So I think it's a harder way to get out of big snow for Boston. It looks very likely that big snow's on the way.
Okay. Now, the storm is projected to form today off the coast of the Carolinas and quickly intensify into something called a bombogenesis. Big word. What does that mean?
Yeah, bombogenesis is a process that when an area of low pressure intensifies very rapidly, we measure these lows in millibars. So if it drops 24 millibars in 24 hours or less, that's considered a meteorological bomb. This one, some of the models are saying it could double that, get close to, you know, a 40 or even 50 millibar drop in 24 hours. The bottom line means it's going to intensify very, very quickly, and that has an impact on how strong the low will be, and really that translates into how much wind there will be. I think wind is going to be a highly underrated part of this storm.
Mark, let me ask you about forecasting models. One of them in Europe suggests New York City will get dumped with snow. You talked a little bit about that. Whereas one model in the U.S. shows a lot less or almost nothing. So why the difference in these models?
Yeah, so the snowfall forecast is highly dependent on the track of the low. And so very small changes in that track have huge differences when it comes to how much snow falls. It's all track dependent. So the European model has that low over the exact right or wrong spot, depending on your point of view, how much you love snow, to give big snow for I-95, while the GFS, the U.S. model, is just a little bit more east and maybe slightly weaker. That combination drops the snowfall totals dramatically. And it's really both of those are in the scope of things that could happen. That's why I said it could be a high bust potential forecast, meaning we shift this low 50 miles off to the east, which globally is almost nothing. It takes the big snow away from some of the big cities.
Okay, and very quick, there could be flooding. Why do snowstorms sometimes produce coastal flooding?
Well, just like any coastal storm, like a hurricane, the wind moves the water. And we're talking about a very strong low with a lot of wind moving that water. So the water's pushed on land. The ocean will come to visit you instead of you going to visit the ocean. The wind will move that water up.
Mark Elliott is a meteorologist with the Weather Channel. We'll be watching. Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
Nobody knows for certain what sets off an eating disorder, but there is growing evidence that the causes are a mix of biological, psychological, and sociocultural factors. High school student Kaylee Brenner brings us the story of one of her friends who is struggling with her body image.
I think it started maybe winter-ish, like beginning, mid-winter-ish of, yeah, it was like November, December-ish of 2020.
This is Elle. We're just using her initial to protect her privacy.
I would describe myself as an empath, a daughter and a sister, a friend. I think I'm caring. I can be passionate and determined.
But she's been struggling with body image.
I always think I'm fat, I'm ugly, and I'm stupid. Like, that's always the first thought. And it's almost like it's not me saying it. It's like in my head, it's someone else saying that to me.
She's not alone. Studies show that nearly 80% of girls our age reported not being happy with their body. And the link between that data and the amount of time you spend on social media is becoming increasingly impossible to ignore. And the worst part is that apparently some of it's by design. Here's Tristan Harris, co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology in front of Congress in 2019.
It was much cheaper to, instead of getting your attention, to get you addicted to getting attention from other people. And this has created the kind of mass narcissism and mass cultural thing that's happening with young people, especially today.
According to Harris, the mental health of teenage girls and the way we see ourselves took a sharp decline with the introduction of platforms like Facebook and Instagram.
We get social media feeds, whether that's Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat, even Pinterest, which I love so much, but like I'm not necessarily seeing all these girls with different body types, and even Photoshop, it's constantly being thrown at us, and it can be like interpreted in our brain and put on ourselves.
I would encourage young women who are looking at media images to critically look at those images and ask themselves, who is profiting by me feeling bad about myself in this moment?
Ellen Robinson is a pediatrician with Novant Health in Winston-Salem. She sees a lot of this. A lot of girls that go to her practice because these feelings of not being able to achieve that Photoshopped flat stomach or perfect legs got to be too much for them to handle.
A lot of patients really have an unhealthy relationship with food and an unhealthy relationship with their body weight. So I would say not a lot of officially diagnosed eating disorders, but lots and lots of patients that have eating issues of some description.
Which brings us back to Elle.
Well, I don't necessarily like how I look.
The feelings of inadequacy. The images she kept seeing online, the little comments here and there, it all caught up to her by the end of 2020. Elle started to purge her food. Now, Elle is a really open person, but she kept this to herself. Nobody in her family knew. And living with this secret, it made her feel guilty.
I think it was one of the things that kind of distanced me as well. Because it was just like another thing that I had to myself and another thing that was pulling me from everyone.
One night, after a fight with her mom, Elle went down to the basement to purge.
I used my fingers. And I have nails. And I saw a little bit of blood come up, and I was terrified. I was so nervous.
She had scratched her throat.
And I was crying, and I was like so worried. And then we eventually got my mom in there, And we had to call a friend who's dealt with this. And she asked us all these questions. We were like panicking, looking up stuff, wondering if we had to go to the hospital. And it was scary.
She did not have to go to the hospital. It was just a small scratch. But it was impossible to hide anymore. Elle needed help. She starts seeing a nutritionist and a therapist. And she's slowly getting better, working hard to be able to accept who she is and not who the internet or other people tell her to be.
And I hope I can one day, because I feel like accepting yourself for who you are is the biggest, it can free you. And I can't wait till I get to that.
For Here and Now, I'm Kaylee Brenner.
And that story was produced by Kaylee Brenner, Sarah Rhodes-Cox, and Sarah Bettis. It comes from WFDD's Radio 101 program in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Education officials in McMinn County, Tennessee, are standing by their ban of the Pulitzer Prize-winning graphic novel Mouse by Art Spiegelman. Spiegelman's story about the Holocaust depicts Nazis as cats and Jews as mice. He based it on his parents' ordeal in the Auschwitz concentration camp during World War II. They survived the camp. Mouse has been included in school curricula since it was first published in 1980, but the 10-member McMinn County School Board cited what it called objectionable language and a cartoon image of a nude woman as it banned the book. So let's bring in Art Spiegelman, the author of Mouse, and thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here. I listened to your show. Thanks.
Well, we appreciate that. What was your reaction when you first heard about this ban?
I've now gotten it down to jaw-dropping disbelief.
Jaw-dropping disbelief.
As you said, like, this has been used in schools for a very long time, usually from middle school on up, and I used to have my doubts, like, is this all right? Am I robbing children of their childhood? Because the book was never made specifically as a young adult or child's book. I have now learned over the last, whatever it is, 30 to 40 years, that there are really intelligent children and really stupid adults, and it's very narrow-minded of me to figure out where it should end up as a book.
So Tennessee bans your book about the horrors of the Nazis and the Holocaust, but of course it was the Nazis who were known for, among other things, for book banning, throwing Jewish books into massive bonfires. Does that strike you as the ultimate irony?
Well, ultimate irony, I think there's a large contest for first place across your newspaper every day now, but this is certainly one of them. There are people in, what's it called, Minn County or McMinn County. Who really want the book taught there, and there are others who don't. Right now, it seems like the local community standards is what's in place, and therefore they can kind of almost laughably get upset about the word damn in a book, even though I think that Gone with the Wind has been available in Tennessee for many decades, as in, I don't give a damn. So they're displacing their real anxieties about teaching this material onto rather silly and short-sighted distractions.
I want to ask you about some of their reasoning. One board member mentioned vulgar and inappropriate content and said, we don't need to enable or somewhat promote this stuff. How do you answer that?
Well, I would say, what's the real inappropriate content? Is the real inappropriate content explaining what happened to millions of people in World War II as a result of their embrace of authoritarianism and fascism? Or is it the word damn? Come on, these kids know the word damn from the time they're saying, damn it, school lunch is going to be late today, says a first grader. What's obvious is that they can't be as upset about those words. It's not like a long streak of potty mouth dialogue. They're in very specific places in the book. They have a purpose. And the so-called nude woman is a very small, one-inch-high picture of my mother in the bathtub. She committed suicide in, seen from overhead in a pool of blood. If that has any titillating value, I can't figure out what part of the brain it would come from.
Well, Mr. Spiegelman, it looks like the ban is actually sparking a renewed interest in your book. We've heard that discussion groups about mouse are springing up in Tennessee, one being held by St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Athens, and sales of the book are up as well. So in the end, an effort to ban your book appears to be backfiring and actually renewing interest in it.
Okay, Anthony, we'll put it on the irony list, because it tends to work that way almost all the time, except when the books are actually burned or the people who wrote the books are actually burned. And I'm glad for the discussions that are going on in McMillan County, and I think my lecture agent is trying to organize something where I'll be in an hour-long Zoom conversation through that either that church or another to talk about the book with interested parties, which could include the school board if they want to be there, and I hope the 14-year-old kids who might be getting the book through other sources or would want to and have some kind of direct conversation.
Mr. Spiegelman, we are in this moment, and you sort of alluded to this earlier, when many local school boards and groups of parents seem to be pushing back on a number of issues, from critical race theory to mask mandates to the inclusion of certain books in this case. So you're suddenly in the midst of this culture war, it seems like. And I'm just wondering how you're thinking about that.
You know, I'm really still trying to sort it out for myself, because obviously books from minorities that haven't been represented in schools for decades because it's a hegemony of attitudes, the books that are coming out on various issues relating to gender, they seem to be the first on the firing line. Now, Mouse, a book that at this point has, forgive me saying it, I'm just trying to give a correct adjective, is canonical. It's been taught in schools for a long time. Even I've gotten used to that fact. And this is not good for their children, even if they think it is. So rather than try to teach down, they should try to do what the people putting together the curriculum for that school were pleading for, which is just let the book be there. It's a curriculum. We support it with other material. In the context that it's presented in, it is hardly a presentation of bad language and hot sex. it's just not that, it's so far from that.
Well, Art Spiegelman, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning graphic novel Mouse, which was banned by a Tennessee school board earlier this month, thank you for talking with us. We're very grateful.
Oh, thanks for having me, Anthony. Good luck. Bye-bye.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Anthony Brooks in Dublin, New Hampshire.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.